Earth explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Earth explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio. This is where the past meets the future. We are coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, up against the Canadian border. We are glad you're here tonight. Our AccuWindow forecast is about 28 degrees outside. Sun's still up, but going down quickly. The solar wind tonight is 391 kilometers per second. And the proton count is up just a little bit, 1.8 protons per cubic centimeter. We try to keep track of that for you Earth explorers, just so you'll know how the source of all energy and life on our planet is affecting us at the moment. No sunspots still. Solar cycle 24, nice and quiet, which means if predictions of a solar pole shift in 2012, and all of the other solar calamities that are predicted to come to pass are to be, it has to hurry up. We have just over 4 years before December 21st, 2012. If you were out in the Arizona desert this week, you might have seen a space vehicle driving around. NASA unveiled a new lunar rover on Friday, which aims to transform space exploration by allowing astronauts to roam large distances without cumbersome spacesuits when they return to the moon by 2020. A team of scientists is testing the small pressurized rover concept vehicle, which resembles a small futuristic RV mounted on six sets of wheels, 12 in all, in trials in a rocky, barren corner of northern Arizona, selected for its similarities to the surface of the moon. no similarity to the Capricorn Project, which was a filmed project which aimed to try to convince people that we never actually went to the moon, but just to northern Arizona. A new prototype has a pressurized cab and is fitted out with leather seats and bunks. It would allow a crew of two astronauts to take extended exploration trips, now get this, for up to 2 weeks at a time, covering distances of up to 625 miles. That is going to give us more flexibility on the moon than ever before. And I can't tell you what a relief it is to see that this quality of space vehicle is making its way to the forefront. A couple of items just by way of update. The biodiesel plant in Odessa, Washington, slightly delayed due to a metering pump failure. Actually, the metering pump was on paper designed to do what it was supposed to do, but when actually put into service, well, it just didn't have enough. So it's going to be delayed for about a week. But it was an interesting trial. We made 500 and some odd gallons of warm canola oil. No harm done. No harm done. Just start over next week, and we'll get this plant up and running. Also wanted to let you know that the holiday special for the Ark of Millions of Years is now up on the website. So if you were waiting to buy all three copies until the new covers were out, they are out now. And if you were waiting for a trilogy special, that too is ready to go. Now, this only pertains to U.S. sales, and that is a restriction placed upon us by our warehouse, because the last special that we ran overwhelmed the staff and they could not keep up with all the foreign orders. We shipped many, many hundreds of books out to Australia, New Zealand, Germany, even Iceland, and the additional customs paperwork that has to be filled out to ship those books just overwhelm the staff. So we are limiting this to 500 sets. So they will go very quickly. If you want to get the trilogy all in a single pack, including shipping, special price, just go to arkofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark. arkofmillionsofyears.com, and click on the holiday special buy now buttons. Now, one is for the hardback and one is for the soft cover. So take your pick. Send them to a friend. Guarantee that they'll enjoy the reading. And we are continuing the special. That means that if they buy all three books, they will get the first two books as an audio download. So when they buy, when they come out of the PayPal receipting process, there will be a button there that will allow them to download the first two volumes. That's over 50 hours of reading. So if they're not great readers, don't worry about it. I read it for them. All you have to do is click on it and send them the books, and then you'll have the audiobooks to give as well. And we are coming up on the end of the year. Now it is almost November, which for our neck of the woods is considered the holiday season. And if you think time goes quickly the rest of the year, you haven't seen anything yet, because the next 8 weeks are going to go so fast. 2009 will be upon us, and new leadership, I believe, will be in place. That being said, the reason that we are doing a special program tonight on the subject of time. Time, it is something we become familiar with as we grow older, but when we're very young, a few minutes seems like an eternity, especially when we're hungry or want to go to the beach or the movies and our parents are lollygagging around. And by the time we're teenagers, we think we are indestructible and that all we have is time. The strongest desire we have is for high school to be over so we can be free of the schedule of school and begin working for our own money, blah, 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 blah. I don't know how many of you wish you were back in high school, but figure out a way to convince your kids to enjoy those 4 years. But by the time we're in our 20s, we realize that time is speeding up and that we have no control over it. Well, that's actually not accurate. What we're going to go over tonight is the reality of time. And maybe we'll open up some concepts for you. You might have heard this on Discovery or History or whatever, but this is a little bit different because this is X Squared Radio. This is where the past meets the future, and it is the place where you can participate. All you have to do is call. Toll-free in the U.S., it is 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, toll-free, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. All you have to do is dial 530-776-5154 or 5185. That's plenty of lines. We can even have two people on at the same time. And for those of you that are, well, those of you that are using Magic Jack, just dial any number you like because it's always free. Or if you're using Skype, you can just reach us at BBS Radio. Or Pal Talk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. Not very many radio networks out there will take digital or cell phone calls. They will if they have to, but this network thrives on it. We have a very eclectic audience out there, and there are millions of you listening. Some live, and many, many more via archive. And if you go to x2-radio.com, of course, you can subscribe to our archives and have access to other neat things like pay-per-view movies. A couple of dollars will get you a 90-minute movie, which is you can watch workshops or you can watch PowerPoint presentations where I have presented on the Hollow Earth, on the origin and destiny of the Earth, and also on the physics of the soul and time travel. Now, it's not just a single viewing. Once you get the subscription, you can actually watch it as many times as you like for 6 months. Now, that's pretty cool. So you can send your friends there. It's right on the front page, pay-per-view movies. And we'll keep adding things as we get interesting things from our affiliates. And please don't forget to visit our affiliates. If you have an inkjet printer, just click on the 123 Inkjets banner. If you love reading about UFOs and the latest in UFO research, we have UFO Magazine. If you want to buy software, we have Academic Superstore. If you want to buy a telescope, we have the Discovery Channel store. There are lots of things, something for everyone for the holiday season. So take advantage of it. No tax, sometimes free shipping, and your dollar goes a lot further. Time. The concept has its origins in the idea of reverse causation. I'm talking about time travel. Yes, time travel. We have a tendency in our rational world to link ourselves to our watch, to the company clock, to some sort of schedule that takes us sometimes minute by minute, hour by hour, calendar dates. And we, by nature of our various lifestyles, punctuate our lives accordingly. We are going to be happy as soon as we get to go on vacation, as soon as we get that five-week pay month. There are two of them each year, you know, but it never seems to work out. You never get to use that extra week of pay. It'll be great when we get our bonus. It'll be great when we retire and we can tap into that huge 401k we've been saving up and we get that Social Security income. Yeah, but it's always just a little bit out of reach because most people do not stay in the now. Ooh, the now. What a unique, interesting concept. Let's see if we can define it. Now. No, I mean now. Okay, no. What I'm talking about is not the decimal point, the one-dimensional flash of your eyes, a blink, almost a shadow out of eyesight. That is not the now I'm talking about. The now I'm talking about is the scope of your vision. Sort of like driving down the highway using a laser pointer as your flashlight. You see, you only have a pinpoint of perspective. And you kind of have to wave it around the road, which means in the dark, you're going to be driving pretty slowly. Because you can't see everything that's around you. You can't take in your surroundings. You can't even see the yellow line on the highway. You can see a dot on the yellow line, and you can't even tell it's yellow because there's just not enough light coming back to your eyes to give you perspective. What we're talking about tonight is time travel. The idea that it is possible to expand the spotlight of your vision. Now, lots of people have written about this. It goes back a long, long way. Now, there's no widespread agreement as to which written work should be recognized as the earliest example of time travel stories. And there's been a number of very, very early works. For example, Memoirs of the 20th Century, and that was written in 1733 by a man named Samuel Madden. It's mainly a series of letters from English ambassadors in various countries to the British Lord High Treasurer, along with a few replies from the British Foreign Office, all purportedly written in 1997 and 1998, although it was 1733, and describing the conditions of that era. Very interesting work, by the way. You should pick it up. The writing is amazingly fluid, very long compound sentences, not anything like we would write today. However, the framing story is that these letters were actually documents given to the narrator by his guardian angel one night in 1728, about 5 years before he wrote the book. So, you know, that's really the first written work that we have, in English anyway, about time travel. Of course, there's lots of time travel in the scriptures about angels or God or gods coming to various biblical figures and telling them about what they were like before they were born in other worlds and what they will be like in other worlds in the future. And all of that. And in our own Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3, the second part of that, the part two of that book, the one that deals with the law of attraction, that book was actually written in the year 2015 and then brought back to the year 2007. So it just gives an interesting perspective. What we're trying to do is just expand your now a little bit. Originating maybe in writing in science fiction, because no, quote, sane scientist or sane writer, nonfiction, would claim that time travel is actually real, that things can actually be tapped into in the future. However, modern science, and I say modern, we go back to the mid-70s, we'll talk about Dr. Ed Mitchell for a moment, astronaut who walked on the moon, who did an ESP experiment with Olaf Johnson and two other doctors just to see if psychic communication was limited to the realm of Earth, or could a man receive premonitions, messages, notions from three individuals on Earth, even though he was 250,000 miles away orbiting around the moon. The fact is, the actual empirical data gathered from that experiment, which was done, by the way, without foreknowledge of NASA, was irrefutable. There is, in fact, a non-local aspect to human communication and consciousness. Aha, so the now has been scientifically proven to be expanded. Time is just distance in space. We call it light years. We call it solar distance. We call it astronomical units, AUs. So we have various means of measuring time. We measure time in cycles per second. And what is a second? Very interesting. Several authors, even Mark Twain wrote a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. That was written in 1889. And a time traveler finds himself in the court of King Arthur. And he brings his, albeit not highly skilled, notions from the future to the past, and has his effect on the past as the past affects him. In reality, we are in the past, right now, because each of us has a consciousness that plods along in somewhat linear fashion toward the future. And it's just, we'll throw a little bit of theory in here. Some theories, most notably, and we're talking about special and general relativity, suggest that suitable geometries of space-time, sort of like a fabric, like a bedsheet, or specific types of motion in space, like very fast motion, close to the speed of light, might allow time travel into the past and future if these geometries or motions are possible. Now, I know that sounds a little difficult to understand, but think of it this way. Suppose you are in San Francisco. You are going to travel to Los Angeles. From a physics point of view, the distance from San Francisco to Los Angeles is identical to the distance from Los Angeles to San Francisco. It's just a mathematical line. It's just an equation. The arrow of time does not necessarily increase or decrease. It is just a matter of distance. And so mathematically speaking, it's just as easy to move backward in time as it is forward. Although, and we'll talk about some of these paradoxes in a moment, there are paradoxes associated with each one. Physicists take for granted that if one were to move away from the Earth at relativistic velocities, that is to say, fast compared to Earth, and then return, more time would have passed on Earth than for the traveler. So in this sense, it is accepted that relativity allows travel into the future. Now, if this was the case, if Einstein's special and general relativity were true, irrefutably true, relative to time, then GPS satellites could not function. It's true. Think about it. Each time you turn on that TomTom, each time you turn on your cell phone that has GPS capabilities, up to 12 satellites are tied into the ID identification of your location, your TomTom, your cell phone, whatever locator that you happen to have. Now, relative to you, those satellites are traveling at different speeds. If Einstein's special and general relativity were irrefutable, that is to say, time changes relative to between two bodies based upon their difference in speed, you would not be able to locate yourself with a GPS satellite. And you know, the designers that worked with Hughes' satellite as they were putting these together and putting together the algorithms that make them run, they were stymied. They could not figure out how to make every single person that would happen to have a GPS sensor get accurate information down to the meter on the Earth when they're all located in different places on the surface of the planet, which means the relativity, the relative distance and speed between the traveler and the satellites was infinitely different. It was a mathematical impossibility. There was just no way. The whole program was almost scrapped, except the engineers decided that Einstein's special and general relativity, when it comes to time and distance, could be set aside. Another scientist, whose last name is Lorentz, Lorentzian physics, say that space is not relative, but in fact linear. And so they designed the UPS satellites to work with Lorentzian physics. And with that design, they worked perfectly. Yes. Every time you go down the highway, your little UPS right there in the right-hand corner, it has your speed, 73 miles an hour in a 70-mile-an-hour zone. Yeah, your speedometer isn't nearly as accurate because the distance and the time it takes you to travel between those two distances are being tracked from space by 12 different satellites and then rounded up to the nearest mile per hour. You might as well keep that record sometime when you get a ticket and you don't think you've been speeding. If you have that GPS handy, just bring it into court because it'll have a little record on there what your speed was. Physics take for granted that if one were to manipulate this, that is to say, apply speed or apply gravity or apply a very powerful electromagnetic field, one might be able to branch into a parallel universe. However, there are some interesting paradoxes. We're going to talk about those in the second hour, and I want those of you out there that have given any thought to this. Someone asked me, a couple of months ago, do you think time travel will ever be invented? And I said, you know, if it takes 100,000 years to actually invent a time machine, it's already invented. It's already here. Because if a person 100,000 years in the future figures out how to travel backward in time, guess where they're going to come? They're going to come right here to the 21st century, because this is where it all happens. This is the time that affects changes upon the future. We are at a pivotal point, not only for our planet, but also for our race. You feel it. I feel it. Many, many people know this is occurring as we speak. We are affecting the future. We are choosing a future. Let's talk about it. Toll free, USA, 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, toll free, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And don't forget, you Magic Jack users, you can use any one of those numbers and it'll come right through. Or if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio, or Pal Talk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. We are coming to you live via the BBS Radio Network, and also through the Steel Eye Media Network, courtesy of our friend Kevin Smith. You get a chance to pick up his show some evening, Monday through Friday, kevinsmith.com. Several popular, very famous physicists, you know, there are a lot of physicists out there that are famous for one thing or another. Stephen Hawking once suggested that the absence of tourists from the future constitutes an argument against the existence of time travel. That's a variant of the Fermi paradox. Now, Fermi was a physicist that worked on the atom bomb, and he had an apparent contradiction between the high estimates of the probability of the existence of, let's call them, extraterrestrial civilizations, and the lack of evidence for or contact with such civilizations. We talked about that last week. we said, look, there are hundreds of thousands of blurry photographs out there. There are hundreds of millions of eyewitnesses. But there isn't a rivet, not a piece of fabric, not a shoe, not a bone, not a fragment of eye tissue, nothing, no hard evidence whatsoever that there are extraterrestrial civilizations visiting Earth. The only event that I know of is the Roswell crash. That would yield hard evidence. But the extreme age of the universe and its vast number of stars suggests that if the Earth is typical, which I maintain it is not, extraterrestrial life should be common. Discussing this proposition over lunch, this is in 1950, Fermi questioned why, if a multitude of advanced extraterrestrial civilizations exist in the Milky Way galaxy, evidence, such as a spacecraft or probes, are not seen. Well, now, they are very seen, very common. A more detailed examination of the implications of the topic began with a paper by Michael Hart in 1975, and it is sometimes referred to as the Fermi-Hart paradox. Michael Hart put this together, and even though the two were not contemporaries, here is the paradox. A great deal of effort has gone into developing scientific theories about possible models of extraterrestrial life, and the Fermi paradox has become a theoretical reference point of this work, that if time travel is possible, that means that large distances of space could be cut down to a weekend or a month, making it completely, completely practical to move between sentient worlds or between galaxies or even between parallel universes. But the absence of evidence says that it's not possible. And in a way, it's kind of a dare, you know. We hear that all the time. Even Stanton Friedman says the same thing. He says, this is not possible, and that's not possible, and there's no evidence of this, and no evidence of that. Even though he's a believer, he's daring anyone who has a piece of it in their backyard to come forward. And then he'll be a believer. He is a believer. Trust me. We've had him on the program. He is a believer. But he's as frustrated as anyone else. And now, he is the world's most famous debunker. So, Stan Friedman works very hard to take apart the credibility of anybody who stands up for extraterrestrial existence here on the Earth without evidence. So, let's talk a little bit about time travel to the past. The past is pretty easy for us to deal with, because we have history books, we have scriptures, we have all kinds of programming and books and photographs and movies of past events. So it's not so hard to travel into the past. And besides that, we have our own memories, do we not? We have our own memories. We have our own recording device in our mind. And unfortunately, each individual recording device puts its own version of it into the historical records. Two people can witness a car accident, and you get quite a different result. I have in the book, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3, we talk a little bit about the paradox of time and the paradox of observation, and the fact that our observation does affect the physics of it. And it works something like this. Two people are sitting in a sidewalk cafe having a light lunch. And, of course, a sidewalk means that you're on the side of a road, which they are, a busy city street. And all of a sudden, right out of the corner of their eye, right there in front of them, a car accident occurs. And the two drivers jump out, neither one seriously injured, yelling and screaming at one another, one dialing the cell phone frantically, and sure enough, law enforcement shows up shortly and begins to calm everything down and order the proper cleanup, and also to take statements from the two drivers. And in getting finished with the statements, looks around and sees the two people sitting at the sidewalk cafe. And he walks over and asks them, did you, either one of you, see anything? Well, yes and no. I mean, we're sitting here minding our own business, having a latte and a muffin, and out of the corner of our eye, bam, here comes this accident. Well, I better get your statement. So he opens his pad. He takes one statement from one person and one statement from the other, and how many different versions do you think he got? You get it. You got it. Two. He gets two versions. So now the cop is not very clear on the situation at all. He thinks with all of this additional evidence, now the testimony of the two drivers and the two witnesses, that he can make a nice, accurate report as to who might have been at fault. And just then, the restaurant owner walks up and says, hey, officer, I have a security camera which watches the sidewalk and may have captured this accident on video. Aha! So the six of them get up, go into the security room, and the officer, the manager, the two witnesses, and the two drivers watch the security film. And guess what they see? That's right. They see directly into the past from an impartial point of view. And of course, with that impartial look into the past, nothing but truth, nothing but reality, nothing but complete unbiased perspective. The one driver says, it was my fault. It was my fault. I was reading the newspaper. I wasn't watching the road. And the other driver says, no, I could see it was my fault. I was putting on makeup, and right before the accident, dropped my lipstick into my coffee and dropped my cell phone down into the side pocket of the door. It was my fault. And so things begin to settle down, and even the two witnesses say, oh, now, I see what happened now. This driver crossed the center line, and they glanced rearview mirrors against one another. Yes. Okay, so everybody changes their statement, and now a clear view into the past has now changed the present and changed all future events that come after it. So you see, a brief look back into our own timeline from an impartial point of view, a pure camera, unbiased, can reveal many habits, can reveal points of view, cycles, echoes that we do to ourselves over and over and over. Why does this always happen to me? Why am I always the one that loses my job? How come I always marry guys like that? How come I always end up with women like that? It's the echo, my friends. It is the echo of your own past over and over and over again, brought to reality by your own observation effect. We'll talk a little bit about that in the third hour. I do want to talk about time for these 2 hours. Now, there are paradoxes with the past. One of the paradoxes is, suppose you open up the family Bible and you're reading the story of how your grandfather met your grandmother. Recorded carefully in handwriting and put into there, you realize that they met at the high school dance. They met at the high school dance. And they wouldn't have, except that your grandfather narrowly escaped an accident where he could have been injured, but he was delayed just a couple of minutes, which allowed him to get to the high school unscathed and meet your grandmother. But suppose you go back in the past and you take care of the distraction and your grandfather gets in the accident and doesn't meet your grandmother and doesn't have your parents, then you are not born. That's the paradox. That you go back and you change something in the past that would affect your existence. We ask the question, would you or would you not still exist, a la Back to the Future? The answer is, will tell you later. The past is observable, and the past is changeable. Not maybe the events that happened in the past, but your perspective of those events, your reaction to those events, the emotion that you harbor, the energy that you bring forward from those events, that can be changed. And in changing that, you change the future. Now, there are some special space-time geometries. The general theory of relativity extends the special theory to cover, of course, gravity, illustrating it in terms of curvature in space-time caused by mass, energy, and the flow of momentum. Think of it like this. Five of your friends, or four of your friends, and you get together. Each one grabs the corner of a bed sheet and pulls it as tight as they can. You settle a bowling ball in the middle of that sheet. Try as they may, they cannot pull the bed sheet tight enough to keep the bowling ball from distorting the threads. But just ask them to hold it as tightly as they can. And then try to roll a marble from one corner to the other, from one friend to another. You will find that the marble will strike that bowling ball before getting to the other side, unless you give that marble a sling wide around that bowling ball, and then it might curve just enough to reach your friend. But if you don't throw it fast enough, it's going to go around and around and around in a spiral, and it's going to end up right next to that bowling ball in the middle of the bed sheet. Now you see what we mean by mass energy and the flow of momentum. As mass moves through space-time, it bends it like the bowling ball bends the bed sheets. Of course, we're talking about large distances, and we are talking about space-time appearing to be straight and flat and nice and, you know, the shortest distance between two points kind of thing. But when we shoot a photon from one point to the other, just like the marble, it follows the curvature of space-time. It looks like it's going straight. We see the stars in the same place in the sky every single night as they track around the rotation of the Earth. But during an eclipse, when the sun goes dark and the stars reappear behind the sun, guess what happens? Our own sun, not very large, deflects the light, the photons coming from those distant stars. And we actually get to see some of those stars a few seconds before they actually clear the limb of the sun. Because the sun is warping space-time. And the photons that left that star hundreds of thousands, millions, perhaps billions of years ago, are following the curvature of space around the sun and to our eyes. And that's why we see distant planets the way we do. And in fact, gravity travels very, very fast. Empirically, we have observed gravity to travel at least 20,000 times the speed of light. 20,000 times the speed of light, maybe more, maybe 200,000 times the speed of light. So you get the idea that if we could gather up gravity, compress it a little bit, and shove it out the back end of some engine of some kind, we might be able to even go faster than time. Oh yes, faster than time, even though we're really not traveling faster than the speed of light. It's true. It's only the relative difference of the two that we see. So a proposed time travel machine using a transversible wormhole could work in the following way. One end of the wormhole is accelerated to some significant fraction of the speed of light. Let's say half the speed of light. And then brought back to the point of origin. Alternatively, another way is to take one entrance of the wormhole and move it to within the gravitational field of an object that has a higher gravity than the other entrance, like a black hole, so to speak, and then return it to a position near the other entrance. For both of these methods, a phenomenon called time dilation causes the end of the wormhole that has been moved to have aged less than the stationary end, as seen by an external observer. But you are going to be an internal observer. Time is going to move the same way it does for everyone else, for everything else, while you're inside that process. But relative to everyone else outside that frame of reference, time is going to slow down for you because gravity has greatly, greatly warped space-time in that area. Just like the bowling ball on the bedsheet. And there are instruments being built and have been built and are being increased in their sensitivity, improved in their sensitivity as we speak. One is the LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. If you get your chance to be up here in Washington State, make sure to make your way out to Hanford. There is a publicly funded facility out there. It's been there for about 13 years, and it's called LIGO, and there are three great scientists out there who are more than willing to tell you everything they know about it. Fred Robb is the project leader, and then they have an electrical engineer and a chemical engineer, both PhDs, that are more than willing to tell you everything they know about how they built this thing and what it is they hope to measure. By the way, it is going to be improved over the next 2 years, and by 2012, we should be able to measure that rift in the Milky Way that we're getting so close to, if that is in fact a black hole. They very much hope to be able to detect those gravitational waves. A massive, massive breakthrough in detection. Really an important breakthrough in detection. The neat thing about it is it's a receive-only method. We don't have to slam particles into each other. We don't have to explode anything. We don't have to send a probe out. We just have to sit there and listen. But according to current theories on the nature of wormholes, construction of a traversable wormhole would require the existence of a substance with negative energy. We call this exotic matter in physics. It's usually material made from neutron stars. It's not like going out and grabbing 2x4s or aluminum tubing or stainless steel girders and welding it together. No, that's not nearly dense enough. We need ultra-dense matter, 14, 15, 25 grams per mole, cubic centimeter, way, way up in density. And unfortunately, we just don't have access to that kind of energy here on this planet. More technically, the wormhole space-time requires a distribution of energy that violates various energy conditions, such as something we call the null energy condition, along with the weak, strong, and dominant energy conditions. You know, there are four forces in the universe. There's gravity, there's electromagnetism, and then there are the strong and weak electromagnetic molecular forces. The strong forces are those bonding forces, like carbon bonding to oxygen, or iron bonding to oxygen, or barium to sulfate. Those are the strong molecular forces. And the weak ones are like Brownian motion and, you know, static and things like that. Those are the four forces in the universe. And, you know, when we talk about things on a quantum level, we're talking about very, very, very small effects, like the Casimir effect. We've talked about that on this program. Casimir was a physicist who knew that if you put two metal plates close enough together in a vacuum, that negatively charged particles will spontaneously appear and disappear between the two and thus cause some kind of attraction. Of course, the problem in Casimir's day is they didn't have the technology to machine ultra-flat plates, and now we do, and Casimir's theories have been vindicated because this force, this attraction, has been verified. But keep in mind, Earth explorers, this is a very, very small force. We're talking a few atoms a few atoms over several square centimeters. It's just not a significant amount of energy. Early calculations suggested a very large amount of negative energy would be required, and so therefore the Casimir effect isn't really something that would work. It's sort of like thinking that you could wind up rubber bands and replace a small block Chevy with it to drive your car. Just not enough power to make it go. Same thing with the Casimir effect. In 1993, however, Matt Visser argued that two mouths of a wormhole with such an induced clock difference could not be brought together without inducing quantum field and gravitational effects that would either make the wormhole collapse or the two mouths repel each other. We talk about vacuum fluctuations. And that's a little hard to cover in a program like this, but think of it like this. You have an amplifier, and it's hooked to a microphone and to a speaker. And although you can sing into the microphone, and the amplifier will amplify your voice, sending those electronic signals to the coil and the speaker, and the speaker will be energized with the power of that amplifier and greatly increase the sound of your voice. But you could take that same setup and take the microphone over and just stick it in front of the speaker. Many of you have been at concerts and actually heard this ear-splitting sound. It's called feedback. It's when a small frequency comes out of the speakers into the microphone. The microphone grabs it, sticks it into the amplifier. The amplifier boosts it several hundred watts, puts it out the speaker, and it goes right back into the microphone, and around it goes. And in about 1 or 2 seconds, you have an ear-splittingly high frequency, or in some cases, low frequency, enough to either make the amplifier clip, which means you've reached the maximum amplification of that amplifier, or you blow the speaker. Unfortunately, with wormholes, there's no such limiting factor. So when you get two wormholes close to one another, the vacuum fluctuation is like that speaker feedback, except with a hugely powerful amplifier ripping the wormhole apart. And the interesting thing is, because of the distance between the two mouths of the wormhole, it actually rips apart before it was formed, because you have so far exceeded the speed of light between the two distances. Interesting. Very interesting stuff. And this is where we're going with this program tonight. Now, this is the basic physics of it. In our next hour, we're going to break this apart, and we're going to make it understandable to you, and then we're going to empower you so that you can actually make this happen on your own. And there's some very, very cool stuff about this, and we will cover that right after the break. So we don't want you to go away. We will be back. And if I can get my music to play here. It was playing. Well, I don't know what happened. Let's try this again. Nope. All right. It seems the lithium battery in my MP3 device has decided to take a tank. Nope. Here we go. Now we got it. Yeah, maybe that's going to work. Nope. It seems I've opened a wormhole between my listening, my playing device, and what's going on tonight. So we will cover that right after the break. Don't go away. Just a couple minutes here, and we'll get this all going for you. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Don't go away. foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to Hour 2 of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, let somebody know down at BBS Radio. We'll get a hold of your affiliate and make sure it happens. You know, this is Internet Paranormal Scientific Talk Radio, and because it is such, we are actually a global audience. We're not a local audience. So if you have a product or an idea that you want to get out to the world, you know, we do accept sponsors and we do run commercials. And believe it or not, although people really like commercial-free broadcasting, they also like to hear what's going on in the world. They like to hear some news. They like to hear about modern products that are out there and ways to improve their lives. And so from time to time we do run an ad, and we do so at the top of each hour here at X Squared Radio. The other 55 minutes is pretty much open. In November, we're going to have a full month of guests. We have been reading books like crazy. The usual menu of guests has been accomplished already. We've been on the air now for 3 years and spoken to almost everyone out there that is available. on just about every scientific subject you can think of, except we don't do ghost stories and we don't do conspiracy theories. However, I did want to let you know that yesterday or early today, U.S. helicopters did go into Syria and attack. They did so because, like other police actions that we have been involved with, Korea and Vietnam, just over the border is a plethora of supply activity, which we are forbidden to involve ourselves in militarily. However, the country that we are assisting in trying to secure its freedom and secure its safety and its autonomy in the region, Iraq, can go over the border. They just needed the equipment to do so, and so that was facilitated. Now, you have to understand, time, and the reason we're talking about it tonight is because we have such a terrible and perhaps wonderful effect on it each and every day. One of the things that you have to come to the realization of is that our society, our world, and thus our universe, is the mathematical sum of the intentions of all the sentient beings in it. Now, the interesting thing to think about is when I say sentient, I don't necessarily mean that they are conscious, that they're conscious. Many sentient beings are unconsciously going through life, although their intentions are very much affecting our society and affecting our lives and our universe. And as they affect the present, which, as we are constantly looking to the future, is our past. We're back here. The only difference is that right now we perceive that we are in physical form, and that when we dig a hole, it really is dug. And when we cut a tree down and it falls in the forest, it really does make noise. It isn't just an imagination. It isn't just an illusion. And yes, you've had and heard and witnessed people tell you that this is all just an illusion, it really doesn't matter. I beg to differ. It does matter. It's vitally important to the universe what we do and how we do it and how we think and how we love each other and how we fear each other. All of that is very, very important. Because the observation effect also affects time. In the present, we do it all the time. In physics, we don't really mean to. It's just that, gosh, we can't see down on the quantum level. And so we have to use instrumentation. We have to use other forms of detection. We bombard our samples with electrons and neutrons. We do neutron spectroscopy. We do scanning electron microscopy. We even do X-ray fluorescent spectroscopy, where we bombard our sample with X-rays. It sputters off an electron from a lower energy or lower electron shell, and a higher energy electron in an upper shell falls in to fill in the hole, and the photon that fluoresces from that is actually what we detect, and since the distance between the electron shells is unique to the element, we can spectrographically decide what is platinum and what is lead, what is silica, and what is calcium pretty easily. However, in reality, we've changed our sample. We bombarded the smack out of it with electrons. We X-rayed it. We shot neutrons at it and let them stick to it. And then when they came off, was it the neutron we put on it or was it another neutron? We don't really know. We just know that you can tell the difference between gold and copper pretty easily using neutron activation spectroscopy. So, and it's also used in all kinds of oncology. They take a drug, which is, in most cases, an enzyme, a very heavy macromolecule that has some large element in it, like bismuth, and they bombard it with neutrons. And, of course, the large nucleus atoms, like bismuth, will suck up one of those protons pretty easily. But it won't stay long. It'll actually come off there in about an hour or two. And so they hurry it up. They go ahead and create the bombarded mixture wisp it over to the hospital, shoot it into your veins. The enzyme takes it to the exact location in the body where they want to apply it, because the enzyme has been designed to do so, whether it's a lymph gland or a liver. And then the bismuth decays, and then the alpha particle comes on and strikes the densest thing around, which, lo and behold, is the cancer cell, kills it. So that's how oncology, how chemotherapy works today. And that's how we use the observation effect in medicine. And we also use the observation effect in all kinds of precise measurement that extends our vision into the very small quantum levels, even into the subatomic particle level, even into strings and waves. And it also extends it way, way out on the macro level so that we can see beyond the stars. We can hopefully one day even see dark matter and dark energy out there in the universe, and tell a little bit more about its age and its lifespan, and maybe even its beginning or multiple beginnings. All of these things immensely perk our curiosity, and so we seek after these things. And we will know them. We will know them, and we will have the knowledge sooner or later. And that knowledge will change us. It will change us, because our observation effect will produce knowledge, and knowledge will empower us to make changes and move away, further away from fables and fantasies and superstitions, toward facts and toward irrefutable, postulatable truisms of the universe, and allow us to grow and evolve as beings. But what did the unconscious do? How did they affect the universe so? Because they are barely human. Oh, they look human. They purchase clothes like a human. They can operate machinery like a human. They can even earn money. They can even have children. And even power the economies of civilizations, but they're unconscious. They don't realize that they are eternal beings having a mortal experience. They don't realize that everything they do or don't do, every moment of every day, will eventually affect the universe. The enlightened, the awakened, the scientist who understands that what he is doing affects the universe, the engineer who understands that he has an effect on all time from this point forward, takes great care, takes great energy in the things that he does and the things that he puts his name on. And he thinks twice, sometimes three times, before making a move, before opening his mouth, before writing a paper or making a criticism. And thus the race evolves. Because any being that consciously does something rises to the next level. And that could be the next level of evil, or it can be the next level of great good. But it does change. You know, one thing most people don't know is that whales do not have an autonomic nervous system controlling their breathing. They have to breathe consciously. They have to think about it. And when they think about breathing, now this is probably the highest intellect animal on the face of the earth. They definitely have more gray matter than a human being. And their language is complex and poetic. And the ability for them to live lifespans well beyond human imagination must give them experience and perspective and an ability to communicate and to remember to a point that a human would have no corollary with that. We have no analog to that. We have 40 or 50 years of really productive conscious thought. We might live to be 100, but the first 9 years of our lives are just trying to figure out how to stay out of trouble. And the last 20 years of our lives, our physical body is creating so much pain and so much interruption to the free flow of our thoughts. That is to say, We may want to go jump out of an airplane, or go windsurfing, or ride a horse, or go hiking in the mountains, but the arthritis and the thrombosis and the worn-out hips and the bad eyesight and the scarred lungs don't allow us to participate in those things. And so we retire into imagination and memory and conjecture, and we live through others. Now we are alive, we're conscious, we have complete 100% control over our life condition, you and me. And so we are scientists with our lives. We have a very powerful observation instrument called our consciousness. And we can control things, and we can manipulate things, and we can evolve things. Our own DNA, our own genes, must choose on a daily basis which proteins to make. With only 25,000 gene pairs and between 120 and 140,000 proteins that must be made to keep the human body supple and productive and able to respirate and digest, it takes a tremendous amount of memory. And the memory is stored in the cell walls of the cells, and it's run like a hard drive, like an EEPROM, a programmable chip, a flexible liquid crystal. But it can't think. It can't even know. It just runs the program. Who is the programmer? You are the programmer. You are the programmer. Yes, you got to put the raw materials in your body. You got to eat the right foods. You got to stay away from the wrong ones. You got to get enough rest. You got to stay out of the ultraviolet radiation. You got to stay out of the gamma radiation, hopefully. And you got to take care of yourself, because gravity is an enemy to these bones, you know. Giants don't walk the earth anymore because gravity wears them out, pulls them apart. We're just the right size for our planet. And so you can consciously evolve. By the time you're 14 years old, not a single atom of your body, not a single atom of your body is the same as when you were born. In another 5 years, it does it again and again and again. And by now, you have completely changed out every single atom in your body a dozen times or more. Many parts of your body, the fast-growing parts, epithelial cells like the lining of your mouth and mucous membranes, your hair, your fingernails, the surface of your eyes, your skin, the largest organ in your body, it changes out all the time. And it's all made from protein and fat. And all that protein and fat is made by genetically dividing cells. And the gene pairs of those cells are controlled by you. You control it. You are not a victim of your genetic makeup. You can change it. You have the diseases and the weaknesses that you have because you do not desire them to leave. That's a strong statement, but that is how powerful the observation effect is on the biochemistry of the human body. And so, how does this have its effect? It has a tremendous effect on the now, on the present, on this exact moment. By the way, how long is a moment? Anybody out there can call in and let us know how long a moment is. Toll-free U.S. 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, toll-free 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. This is a three-hour program, and if you're not getting all 3 hours, please let us know, and we'll get with your affiliates and get that changed. because this is Internet Talk Radio, you can tune in any time you like. But right now, for another hour and a half, we're live, and you can call in, and you can become a part of history. One of the other great physicists out there, Dr. Kip Thorne, took very risky professional risks in writing a book called Black Holes and Time Warps. They, in recent calculations, indicate that simple masses passing through time travel wormholes could never engender paradoxes. There are no initial conditions that lead to paradox once time travel is introduced. If Dr. Thorne's results can be generalized, they would suggest, curiously, that none of the supposed paradoxes formulated in time travel stories can actually be formulated at a precise physical level. That is, that any situation you can set up in a time travel story turns out to permit many consistent solutions. Yoda put it another way when trying to explain it to Luke Skywalker. The future is always in motion. Difficult to say. The future is always in motion. The reality is there are multiple futures. Multiple futures. And so when the prophets reach out into the future and they write and they tell us different things that are going to happen, these are conditional futures, by the way. Conditional futures. Nostradamus, Edgar Cayce included. It means that if conditions continue the way they are, barring any change, barring any, shall I use the word, enlightenment, this is what is going to happen. Those of you that tuned into the History Channel recently saw a special called God and Satan, and all of the predictions that were due to come out, the rising of the Antichrist, the building of forces that will take place in a great battle called Armageddon, in a valley, Armageddon. The forces of evil and the forces of good, one would rise to power and blah, 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 blah. You know the story. It's all eschatological. That's not to demean it, but to say, yes, it is a future. But like the condition of our bodies, it is not the one that is written in stone. We are in charge of the future. We are the ones that make the future. Armageddon will happen only when we say it will happen. Now, these parallel universes might provide a way out of the paradoxes, and they do. Quantum mechanics suggests that all possible quantum events can occur in mutually exclusive histories. In this program and in our writings, we call it the potential of all potentialities. Think of it like this. Think of it like a cone, like an ice cream cone, not like a pyramid, not flat, but something three-dimensional. The point of the cone is the beginning of your life, the beginning of the universe, the beginning of the earth, the beginning of sentient life, modern man, the beginning, whatever beginning you want to pick. Theoretically, everything extends out in a square root function in ever-increasing radiuses at a linear rate, or actually at a square root rate, so that you get nice straight sides to the cone. Now, this is the potential of all potentialities. Each past event makes possible a number of future events. And then there is another shape I want to consider. It's called a parabolic cone, and this is one that does not have straight sides to the cone, but rather has curved sides to the cone, much like a bullet would have, or something shaped like a boat. And in reality, what happens is, as we observe and don't observe, participate and don't participate, become conscious and are not conscious, we undulate the side of the potentialities. In other words, the choices that we make each day affect the futures that we can have, correct? if you decide to drink and drive and you end up losing your license, you have a certain future that you cannot have anymore. If you decide to commit a crime and end up going to jail for a felony, the futures that you have are greatly truncated compared to those who can still vote and still get a student loan and these kinds of things. Your present, the things that you do, that you think, the things that you don't do, the things that you don't study, all affect the future. It's sort of like the woman who prays all the time, Lord, Lord, please, please, let me win the lottery. And after 5 or 6 years, the Lord finally comes to her and says, Lady, give me a break. Buy a ticket. This is the way we go through life. We don't participate. We don't involve ourselves in the risk. We don't make the investment by reading the books and practicing the math, taking a class, trying new things. And so the future has become limited, and thus the parallel universes in which we can participate and bilocate also become limited. Now, these alternate or parallel histories would form a branching tree symbolizing all possible outcomes of any interaction. Think of it like a crystal growing. If you've ever seen it under a microscope, just take a slide, spread some water out on it, and then freeze it. And while you're freezing it, shine some polarized light at it and look at it while it's freezing. Watch the growth of the crystal. It's quite amazing. It's not linear at all. It has all kinds of different right and left-hand turns that it makes. And there's been lots and lots of study done on this. Dr. Emoto did some wonderful studies on how human consciousness affects the freezing of water. Unobserved, or should I say not positively observed water, freezes like a lump, just like a disorganized lump of ice. But water that has been concentrated on with positive thoughts and positive energy from a human being, when frozen, makes beautiful geometric snowflakes. And this is a repeatable experiment. It's been done many, many times. Dr. Bill Tiller talks about the conscious effect on the pH of water. That is the inverse log of hydrogen protons in water. Big, big effects. And these are all biochemical effects. We are made of water. We are sensitive to pH. Our consciousness affects those two things repeatedly in scientific experiments. So if all possibilities exist, any paradoxes could be explained by having the paradoxical events happening in a different universe. Hence, if you went back in time and you prevented your grandfather from meeting your grandmother and thus your parents were not born, would not at all mean that you don't exist in the future. Of course you do. It's just there's another future where your grandmother married someone different and had a different set of children. That is true. And so the paradoxical events are easily accommodated in the potential of all potentialities. The concept is most often used in science fiction, but it usually is. Some physicists, such as David Deutsch, have suggested that if time travel is possible and the, quote, many worlds interpretation is correct, then a time traveler should indeed end up on a different history or in a different history line or a different future line than the one he started from. On the other hand, Stephen Hawking has argued that even if the many worlds interpretation is correct, we should expect each time traveler to experience a single self-consistent timeline so that time travelers remain within their own world rather than traveling to a different one. You can already see the flaws in that thinking. It is quite observable that enlightened conscious beings exist in multiple universes at the same time. Parallel lines, side by side by side, drawing from experiences from multiple timelines. Now, you might say, gee, that's crazy. I mean, how could somebody have five careers? I have all literary and musical and mathematical and architectural and geological and geographical and oceanographic experiences that they can bring to bear. But they do. There are a handful of individuals in each generation that master this, often said to be beyond their time, before their time, out of sync, impossible beings with impossible knowledge, couldn't happen in that time and day. And now I can tell you, as time accelerates and density increases, as multiple universes are brought to bear, one upon another, by these enlightened beings, that time accelerates. That is to say, the amount that can be accomplished in the same linear time has exploded and will continue to explode. In fact, the rate of increase is increasing so fast it can barely be measured. Now, in our day, there is not a handful of these beings on the earth. There are hundreds of thousands of them. And they are bringing to bear multiple parallel universes, bi-locating, tri-locating from different information streams, all coming to bear in this one, this time, right now. This is an amazing phenomenon. In physics, we call this quantum entanglement, quantum teleportation. It's called the EPR paradox. It simulates faster than light communication. I say simulates, here's what I mean. We have identified repeatedly, almost as a matter of course now, not even worthy of new Nobel Prizes, although it's about to be applied in a way that might be a little beyond your imagination. I'm going to explain it in about 10 or 20 minutes here. The idea is that two ions are that have particles upon them that rotate or revolve in an entangled manner are separated. Now, what I mean by an entangled manner, there's a principle called the Pauli exclusion principle. And it basically means that where there is one particle revolving in one direction, there must be another particle revolving in another direction. No two particles can occupy the same space at the same time with the same energy. This principle, we often call this a plus half and minus half spin on a particle. Particle spin is very important in physics in adding up and balancing atomic equations. Particles that display this behavior are then separated by an infinitely large distance. In the early days, back in the early 1990s, it was a few inches, which on an atomic scale, it might as well be on the other side of the universe. But in 1999, it was done by 11 kilometers. 11 kilometers is, forget about it. I mean, it's not even in the same area code. Two particles separated, and then electromagnetically, the spin of one particle on that ion is reversed. It's just flipped using an electromagnetic switching. Instantaneously, and I don't mean by the speed of light, I mean instantaneously, the sister ion, the particle on that sister ion, reverses spin at exactly the same moment. Yeah. Now that's called non-locality, non-local. It means that the two particles are somehow entangled. We don't know why, we don't know how, we just know they do it, and we teach it, and we make them do it. Still trying to understand it. So this is the mechanism that allows for faster than light communication, or what we might call time travel. It really doesn't. Time thinking of it in terms of distance. It's a human aspect that 186,000 miles per second is the speed of light. But the second is what is relative, according to Einstein. But the 186,000 miles is also relative. It's also relative. It means that if that distance really doesn't exist at all, it's parallel to one another, and the two particles can switch spin instantaneously, you know what you have. You have a switch. You have a binary event. You have an on and off, a zero and a one. In the book, we call it the beryllium ion modem, a BIM for short. A beryllium ion modem allows a remote sensor, a remote listening station, sort of like a telegraph key on the other side of the universe, to be pecked. Positive, negative, plus one half, minus one half, plus one half, minus one half. And at the same time, its sister particle here on Earth switches at exactly the same time and instantaneously. And so at some frequency, whether it's ultra-low frequency, extremely low frequency, which we call ELP, or at very high frequency, like microwave or even higher frequencies, guess what we can do? You guessed it. We can communicate across space and time instantaneously. That means when we drop a probe onto Mars, we can communicate with it, we can send it instructions, and it can send back information to us instantaneously. And it could just as easily do it from the 43 million miles away on Mars, or 43 million light years. Now, this is the part that's going to stretch your brain. It already does that. That's right. In the universe, there are creation events that occur all the time. We call them supernovas. Supernova is a step in the death of a star. As the hydrogen becomes exhausted and helium is now the majority atom on that sun, and by the way, these suns need to be at least 1.4 times our sun for this to work, but usually they're much larger than that. Gravity begins to win the battle between explosion and the sun collapses. And as the sun reaches a point where the same amount of gravity is packed into a smaller and smaller space, the electrons can no longer stay afloat, orbiting peacefully around the protons, and they collapse into the proton, neutralizing it. Minus one and plus one become zero, become neutral, and the proton becomes a neutron. And the star, once bright and luminous and full of life and fostering life throughout the universe, becomes a neutron star, putting out a whole different light, same gravity signature, just a completely different frequency. But that event, that slamming of the electrons into the protons, is one sudden event, causes a concussion, which we call a supernova, cleaving the atmosphere off that star and creating a shock wave of energy that consumes usually every planet in its solar system and well beyond, converting all of it into pure energy and accelerating lower order particles such as iron into higher order particles, much heavier, much more complex, stratified. And in that creation event, all of that matter is entangled. That means that the event that created this world and all the matter on it that makes up all the proteins in your body, all the calcium and manganese, all the salts, even the water in your body, was created by that supernova event. And so the peas and carrots and wheat thins that we eat now, the milkshakes and the energy drinks and everything that we consume, is full of particles that are entangled with other particles in the same sphere of influence of that supernova, which could be well out into the light years from here. And now you see that the very matter, the very three-dimensional matter that makes up your body, is entangled with other bodies on this planet, with the planet itself, with other planets, and with other beings on other planets. And now you see how your observation of the universe, whether you're watching a cable news channel recycling negativity and fear into you every 30 minutes, day after day after day, and you are recycling that in your brain and in your psychosis and in your patterns and interactions with other human beings, including your children, your husband, your wife, your mother, your sisters, your classmates, your coworkers. You emanate that consciousness all over them, switching the spin of the particles in your body and thus in their body and thus in the planet around you, and you are affecting the universe. What we're trying to get you to do is realize that you have that effect. Realize that you are empowered with that ability, and thus you are saddled with the responsibility to use it wisely. Now, at first, people say, holy cow, I'm in charge of my life condition. I don't like my life condition. I'm sick. I'm poor. I'm underprivileged. I'm in captivity. I have no opportunity. Me, 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 I. And guess where you're going? The same place you've always gone. What I'm telling you is that it isn't that way. It's we, it's us, and it's you with the planet. If you have a condition you want to walk away from, you do not have to wait. Likewise, we have our local condition, whether it's employment, or whether it's education, or whether it's an interaction or a relationship with another person. How you manifest your energy, and it is very real, not just on a quantum level, but also on a macro level, you are affecting the universe. You are changing, evolving the genetics that make up your body, that make up your friends' bodies, and also make up the earth itself. And so the earth is relying upon us. Now, the relativity of what we call simultaneity in modern physics favors the philosophic view known as four-dimensionalism, in which past, present, and future events all coexist in a single space-time. Now, did you get that? You remember what I talked about in the first hour about being in the now, about understanding what the now is? And the now is not going down the highway using a laser pointer as a headlight. Listen to this again, very carefully. We're talking about the relativity of simultaneity. We call it four-dimensionalism, in which the past, present, and future events all coexist in a single space-time. That's why we call it X squared radio, where the past meets the future. Now consists of all of that. I asked you 30 minutes ago to define for me what is a moment. One of my friends, Og Mandino, his full name Augustine, but you know him as Og, great author, fantastic author, if you get a chance to read The World's Greatest Salesman, do it. Great book. Og was interviewing a woman who had lived an inordinately long time. Maybe it was 109 years old. And in the interview, he asked her several questions. If there was, to what did she attribute her long life? And she said a diet of tomato juice and whiskey. I don't know. But, you know, what did she enjoy doing? And she said that she enjoyed several things. And he said, well, if you had it to do over again, you know, is there anything that you would have learned? And she said, yes, I would have learned to dance. I never learned to dance if I had it to do over again. And also, you know, he asked her, was there anything special, you know, about your life? I mean, is there one thing that really stands out? And she said, well, you know, my life, it's 109 years, I've seen a lot come to pass, and you know, my life had its moments. But if I had it to do over again, that's all I'd have, is just moments, one after the other. We have time that goes by in our lives in which there are no moments, or the moments are so long and dreary and boring that we can't wait for it to be over. And some moments that are so fantastic and so bright and so beautiful that we wish they would last forever. I ask people sometimes, what is your dream? What is your dream? And I see their eyes kind of look back to some 10-year-old, 9-year-old playground vision. And they say, I don't know. I mean, I forgot. I one time I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to be a great architect or a race car driver or a fireman. I don't know. I don't really have a dream now. I mean, my whole life is kind of have to. I'm asking you, please sit down tonight with a blank piece of paper. Don't draw any lines on it. Don't divide it left and right and all that stuff. And just write down what your dream is. I don't care what it is. I don't care how old you are. Just write it down. What it is, not that you want to have. I don't want to hear about it. That's the stuff you put behind magnets on your refrigerator. I mean what you want to be. I mean what you want to do. Because what you are and what you do are what affect the universe. It isn't what you drive. It certainly isn't what you wear or don't wear. It is barely your physical existence at all, whatever body you might have. Whether it's one of those we consider to be immensely talented in one form or another, be it sports or fashion, or whether you have immense intellect and can remember things like a computer, or like friends that I have who just have a large room and they learn things and just throw things into the room, they remember, it's just the recall that's the problem. Or whether you have all the parts you're supposed to have or don't have, or whether all your parts work or don't work. You still have a dream of being or doing something. The having comes later. In fact, the having is irrelevant. And the interesting thing is all the wars that we have, all the bombs that we fling at each other and the horrible things we wish upon each other don't have anything to do with the being and the doing. Only the having. Imagine if we could just leave that on the shelf for a while. A little philosophy to go with it now. Four-dimensionalism, in which past, present, and future events all coexist in a single space-time. Layers and layers and layers of planes of universes, all accessible simultaneously by you. Yeah. So, in a way, we call this presentism. Maybe. It's a school of philosophy that holds that neither the future nor the past exist. Not true. They all exist. All the time. The future is occurring right now. And the past is occurring right now. And we can visit it anytime we wish. And when we visit it, we affect it. We affect it. Now, we're going to talk about many types of time travel. And we can do that, and tools for making it happen. One we talked about was using exotic matter. Another one is to actually stress certain molecules, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Because it's important that you know that this can be done. Now, I'm obviously not going to give you a detailed enough description over the radio, so that you can go build a time machine, because that would be immensely dangerous. You would actually rip the space-time continuum with your irresponsible meddling with space-time. But nevertheless, It has been done, and it will be done again. So I want you to stay tuned, because what we're about to talk about is going to go well beyond your imagination. Hang in there, and we will definitely be back with more of X Squared Radio. You know, it's something that we lose perspective of for some reason. It's easy to get locked up in the present, to say, you know, woe is me, you know, I got my house payment is due in a few days, and my insurance hasn't paid off my medical bills, and it's easy to feel that kind of stress. And the world is feeling it right now. The world is feeling it right now. That stuff, that cash that you have in your pocket, guess what? It's about to go away. That's true. I mean, it's to the point now where governments are almost going to say, you have 30 days to turn your cash back into the bank, or it's not going to count. Everything is going to go electronic. But that's okay. That's okay, because we exist independent of that, and we will talk about this in great depth. You don't go away. You take care of yourself. Go get something to drink. Come back. We have about 45, 50 minutes left. X Squared Radio. We'll be back after these messages. Down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back. X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. That's what we're doing right here. We're talking about time. And in this hour, I'm going to talk about a time travel device, how it was discovered and how it actually functions and works. You probably still won't have enough information to build one on your own, but we've had Dr. Ronald Mallett on the program, and he was seeking funding to build his time travel device, or at least a time viewing device, in which he was stirring time electromagnetically with photons. What we're about to talk about is actually stressing the space-time continuum using water, and I'll tell you why and how that came to be. I probably told this story before in this program, but it's important because we have about 20 million listeners that come in and out of X Squared Radio live and archives over the weeks and months, and they don't listen to every program, and so a lot like the cable channels, we have a tendency to repeat stories from time to time just so that you'll get it all. We'll talk a little bit about mutable and immutable timelines, so that you understand the complexity of the subject and how great minds have thought about this, probably well beyond what you've seen in novels or in movies, but you'll become fascinated more and more with the time travel movies as they come out, because, you know, how we affect time is now well understood. The problem is that once we affect it and we go to a future, it's difficult to go back to that past, change it, and then try a different future. Oops, I didn't like the way this one worked out. I didn't win the lottery. I didn't. I had all my investments stolen from me, or I built on the wrong side of the tracks, or I didn't go to the right school, or I didn't go to school at all. If I had it to do over again, I would do that. Well, yes and no. You can't try it again. One resulted in a world war. Let's try another one and see if we don't have that happen. I'll give you an example of a immutable timeline. You have a device that can send a single bit of information back to itself at a precise moment in time. Receive a bit at 10 p.m. and then no bits for 30 seconds after that. If you send a bit back to 10 p.m., everything will work fine. However, if you try to send a bit back to, say, 15 seconds after 10 p.m., a time at which no bit was received, your transmitter will mysteriously fail. Or your dog will distract you for 15 seconds, or your transmitter will appear to work, but as it turns out, your receiver failed at exactly 15 seconds after 10 p.m. Examples of this kind of universe are found in a novel called Time Master by... interestingly enough, the name is Dr. Robert Forward. And also in the Twilight episode, No Time Like the Past, and the 1980 Jeannot Schwartz film Somewhere in Time, based on Richard Matheson's novel, Bid Time Return. An example which could conceivably fall into either 1.1 or 1.2, these are examples, can be seen in book and film versions of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Harry went back in time with the Hermione to change history, you know, the little device that she wore around her neck. As they do so, it becomes apparent that they are simply performing actions that were previously seen in the story, although neither the characters nor the reader were aware of the causes of those actions at the time. They saw them, they witnessed them, but you don't realize until later in the movie that he actually went back and laid those things in place. This is another example of the, quote, predestination paradox. It is arguable, however, that the mechanics of time travel actually prevented any paradoxes, firstly by preventing them from realizing a prior or a prion, a priori, that time travel was occurring, and secondly by enabling them to recall the precise action to take at the precise time and keep history consistent. You remember the movie Paycheck with Ben Affleck. He wakes up in an office and he has some seemingly insignificant items with him, a paper clip and some other things. He realizes that he's under arrest and that something's going to happen to him, and lo and behold, he can make a key out of the paper clips, and he does, and he gets out of his handcuffs and out of the room and escapes. And each time he needs something in the movie, he has it in his pocket, whether it's a newspaper or some special tool, or he knows when to duck. And then he realizes that he had sent all this stuff back to himself from the future of that he had traveled to. And then, of course, he had forgotten that he'd been there. Very interesting movie. It's a really neat time travel paradox. By the way, at the end of the movie, he does deliver himself the winning lottery number in his birdcage paper. So, there you go. In any event, that appears to have caused a paradox. Instead created a new timeline. The old timeline remains unchanged, and then a new one simply lays beside it, and you live the new one. The old one doesn't go away. A difficulty with this explanation, however, is that conservation of mass energy would be violated for the origin timeline and the destination timeline, and that is only if you think that the system set, that is to say the parentheses around the life condition, only involve one universe. They do not. The parentheses are well outside human consciousness, and there's, for all intents and purposes, a limitless supply of energy. We just need to convert it into the form that we need at the time. That's one of the problems we have in physics, is we think that when we plug something into the wall, we only have a certain amount of horsepower, less all the drag and the length of the pipe and the length of the wire and the size of the inertia that we're overcoming and all of that to work with. And in reality, there are energies outside the parentheses. If we just knew how to tap into it and bring it into the system set, we almost could drive for free. Now, mutable timelines, really quickly. Time travel in a type 2 universe is much more complex. The biggest problem is how to explain changes in the past. One method of explanation is that once the past changes, so too do the memories of all the observers. This would mean that no observer would ever observe the changing of the past, because they will not remember changing the past. That is to say, when you change the past, all the memories associated with that change too, so you can't tell the difference between what was and what is now. Kind of interesting. So, like the butterfly effect, where the guy receives, after he goes through his butterfly, after his movement through time, he gets sort of a Reader's Digest version of the past, all coming slamming into it, but it doesn't prepare him for the current future. So, thus, mutable timelines don't really apply, because we do remember multiple pasts. And we do make changes that alter the present and thus alter the future. And the point is, the more beings that figure this out, the more fluid and more dynamic the present becomes. And then you realize that no book can outline for us the and only the future that we are going to go through. So how does this occur? How can we build a machine that will actually move us through time? Let me tell you how one such machine was built. You won't read about it in any history, yet it is being written as we speak. I'm not going to tell you the author. It isn't me, but it's coming out soon. After World War II, several prisoners of war on all sides were released. One such prisoner of war was in a Russian prisoner of war camp. To give you an idea of this man's will to live, he was 6'4" and weighed 90 pounds when he got out of prison. He survived, and he became a salvage expert, a quasi-deep-sea diver, one that walks on the bottom with weighted shoes and self-contained breathing, pulling a cable, hooking it to German submarines that were scuttled off the Hudson Bay of New York after World War II. And he would grab onto these, pull them up, cut them apart, sell them, and that's how he made his living. Pretty good business. Him and his wife were quite successful. One day he goes over the side of the boat, down to the bottom he goes, carrying the cable. And he has about an hour of air. And after an hour, his wife becomes worried. After an hour and a half, the crew are all leaning over the side of the boat. After an hour and 45 minutes, they're calling in rescue ships. Of course, you know, the Hudson is not the clearest bay these days, and wasn't much clearer back in the 50s. After 4 hours, helicopters, boats, divers, the man comes to the side of the boat and hops over the side. His wife and frantic crew wondering where in the world he had been, how he had survived. The most amazing thing was he'd only used 15 minutes of his air. And then he told his wife a story. And then he told my friend the same story. While I was walking along the bottom, he said, I saw a shape, a shadow, in the distance. I determined that it was probably a U-boat sitting on the bottom, scuttled many years before. I intended to hook my cable to it and let the winch of my boat pull the ship to the surface so that we could salvage the iron. However, in trudging forward with the cable, I passed through a wall of air and fell flat on my face in the mud on the bottom of the Hudson. And there in front of me was not a submarine, but in fact a spaceship sitting on the bottom, having pushed back the water all the way around it so it sat in the dry, as did I. In peeling back my mask and dropping my regulator from my mouth, I realized that I could breathe. It was air. In utter astonishment, I got to my feet and realized that there were two small beings standing in front of me. Without moving their mouths, they communicated to me and asked if I would like to come aboard. I acknowledged that I would. I followed them onto their ship, and as I looked around the ship, I noticed in the center of the ship was their method of propulsion. About 5 feet, 5.5 feet high, and about 8 feet in diameter, was a large, shiny, almost bronze-colored cone with many, looked like blades on it. Not like knife blades, more like impeller blades. And the bottom of the cone was sitting in water, and they explained to me that when they went to move their ship, they would just spin this cone, which would pull the water up into the cone. At first, the water would begin with a very small area in which to enter the process, and then that water, that area, would expand rapidly. The centrifugal force pushing the water out toward the outside of the shape and yet ripping the water apart. And then at the very end of that cavity, creating a tiny little cavitation chamber with a special shape. And as this was spun, it stressed the water molecule. And it wasn't seawater. It was special fresh water. We call it deionized water. Absolutely pure. No ions in it. Specially filtered and prepared. As this water was stressed in that kind of volume, it creates an envelope in space-time. The ship placed in that envelope can simply move through a moment of time, large distances. And that's how space-time is manipulated by this machine and allows the ship to have the semblance of propulsion. My friend, being a world-class engineer, having worked on many projects from aluminum magnets to gold magnets, yeah, that's right. I mean a device that can pick up aluminum cans, a device that can pick up gold coins, a device that can pick up silver. Yes. Yeah, it exists. He was given this description of this machine and promptly set about fashioning it after many, many months and many different trials and errors of machine aspects. He determined that the unit had to have special characteristics. I can't share them with you now, but if you call in, we might talk about it, depending on the complexity of your question. Toll free, 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And don't forget, if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio or PalTalk at BBSRadio_com. And don't forget to visit x2-radio.com. Visit our affiliates on the left. And if you're just joining us, you also need to know that the Ark of Millions of Years holiday special, all three books for a fixed price, including shipping, U.S. only, is now available. It went up today at arkofmillionsofyears.com. This is an even better special than what we had on the Coast to Coast program. This allows you to buy all three books as a trilogy with the new covers and the audio versions of the first two books as a download that come with the purchase. And the purchase price will include shipping. And believe me, it's a good price. And go there, pick it up, send it to a friend for Christmas or other holiday, and you'll have it. You need to know that this time machine has been built, and it has been tried, and it did have an effect on space-time. Not just a few seconds, and not just once. And that's why we can't give out the exact design over the air, and I can't put any pictures on the website, because indiscriminate use of this device would rip the space-time continuum apart. And we don't want that to happen. Now, there's a difference between time travel and space-time travel. And what I'm talking about here probably is space-time travel. And what we have been talking about is time travel. And let's see if we could put it in better perspective, because most people are going to have a hard time with this. They're going to go, yeah, yeah, yeah. Unless, of course, you're a physicist. Then you're going to give me two thumbs up and say, right on. Time travel, in our respect, is more like time awareness. Time awareness. It doesn't mean, like Star Trek, you can go back to the holodeck and experience the time of the day in a jazz bar or in a 1920s speakeasy. It means that you can become aware of those things and thus you think you're just picking up the memory or just picking up the perspective of it, but you have also put your energy in that place, and you have thus changed it. And more you're going to see this in the news, because your timetable is not mutable. That is to say, you do not receive a new set of memories replacing the old memories when you change the past. You retain both, and thus you gain perspective that is quite remarkable. Now, many times this has resulted in problems. You know, we built the Philadelphia experiment, for instance, where Tesla's technology, against his will, was built by the U.S. military in an effort to try to make a cloak a ship. And a destroyer escort, the USS Eldridge, was fitted with the required equipment at the naval yards in Philadelphia. Testing began in the summer of 1943. Tesla was quite aged at the time, and was successful to a limited degree. One test on July 22, 1943, resulted in the Eldridge being rendered almost completely invisible, with some witnesses reporting a greenish fog in its place. However, crew members complained of severe nausea afterwards. At that point, the experiment was altered at the request of the Navy, with the new objective being invisibility solely to radar. The equipment was not properly recalibrated to this end, but in spite of this, the experiment was performed again on October 28th. This time, the Eldridge not only became almost entirely invisible to the naked eye, but actually vanished from the area in a flash of blue light. According to some accounts, the U.S. Naval Base at Norfolk, Virginia, just over 215 miles away, reported sighting the Eldridge offshore, whereupon the Eldridge vanished from their sight and reappeared in Philadelphia, 215 miles away, at the site it had originally occupied, in an apparent case of accidental teleportation. The psychological effects of the experiment on the crew were profound. Almost all the crew became violently ill. Some suffered from mental illness as a result of their experience. Behavior consistent with schizophrenia is described in other accounts. Still others, like Jacob L. Murray, were physically unaccounted for. Supposedly, they vanished, and five of the crew became fused to the metal bulkhead of the ship. Still others faded in and out of sight. Sometimes they disappeared. Then crewmates would stick their hands into the spot from which they had disappeared and try to grab the crewmate. But if they did not, that spot would burst into flames. Horrified by these results, Navy officials immediately canceled the experiment. All of the surviving crew involved were discharged. In some accounts, brainwashing techniques were employed in an attempt to make the remaining crew members lose their memories concerning the details of their experience. Now, that's the Philadelphia experiment, and that's just the description in a nutshell of what happened there. There is a lot more, because in an effort to correct this, and it's evident that maybe there were off-worlders helping with this, and that is a project called the Montauk Project. Now, the earliest memories of the Montauk Project is uncertain, but elements of the story have circulated since at least the early 1980s. According to UFO researcher Jacques Vallée, the Montauk experiment stories seem to have originated with the account of Preston Nichols, who claims to have recovered repressed memories of involvement. There is no definitive version of the Montauk Project narrative, but some accounts describe it as an extension or continuation of the Philadelphia experiment. They were more or less trying to correct the rip in time that they had created with the Philadelphia experiment. Researchers purportedly created a report about their proposals, which was presented to the United States Congress and rejected as far too dangerous. by resubmitting their project directly to the United States Department of Defense and bypassing congressional approval, the researchers promised a powerful new weapon that could induce the symptoms of psychotic disorders and schizophrenia at the touch of a button. The Department of Defense approved. Funding supposedly came from a cache of $10 billion in Nazi gold recovered from a train found by the U.S. Army soldiers in a train tunnel in France near the Swiss border. The train was blown up and all of the soldiers involved were killed. When those funds ran out, additional funding was secured from ITT and Krupp AG in Germany. By the way, Krupp was highly involved in the trying to come up with aluminum magnetism, and that was finally solved by a civil engineer out of New York, and was on the cover of USA Today, and I mean the whole cover of USA Today, and had several television specials covering it. Very real. It does work. And here is the gist of it. Work began at Brookhaven National Laboratory at Long Island, New York, under the name of the Phoenix Project, but was soon realized that the project required a large and advanced radar dish, and installing one at Brookhaven National Laboratory would compromise the security of the project. Luckily, the U.S. Air Force had a decommissioned base at Montauk, New York, not far from Brookhaven National Laboratory, which had a complete SAGE radar installation. The site was large and remote, and Montauk Point was not yet a tourist attraction. Water access would allow equipment to be moved in and out undetected. More importantly, the SAGE radar worked on a frequency of 400 megahertz to 425 megahertz, right in the range of the 410 to 420 signal that was said to influence the human mind. Equipment was moved to Camp Hero at Montauk Air Force Base in 1967 and installed in a deep underground military base that the National Security Agency, the NSA, and the Office of Naval Intelligence, the ONI, were redeveloping and expanding beneath Montauk Air Force Base on the surface at Montauk Point. According to conspiracy theorists, to mask the nature of the project, the site was closed in 1969 and donated as a wildlife refuge park, with the provision that everything underground within the D-1 base would remain the property of the United States Air Force, although technically, in reality, Montauk Air Force Base remained in operation until 1987. The park has never been opened to the public under the excuse of environmental contamination. So you have some conspiracy theorists, but you do have real-world companies, real dollars being spent, and the project was conducted, and it is said that the rift in space-time was not repaired, and that we have the Bermuda Triangle to blame for this rip in space-time. By the way, this engineer that I'm speaking about anonymously, after the television special, because it came out in video and it was all over the news, and we're talking about a room the size of a rail car filled to the top with aluminum cans that had been picked off of a conveyor, by the way, right through steel, not even affecting the steel, just picking up the aluminum cans as a recycling project. His door was knocked upon, and members of a powerful Western utility company were at his door. We saw your special on TV last night. We were quite impressed by it. We don't know how you did what you did, but we've been working for a long, long time on that, and we've been using immense amounts of power. We don't know how you're doing what you're doing with wires the size of a human hair. How in the world you're doing that is beyond us, and we'd like to know what you know. But even more than that, while we were working on this, we had a problem. We lost somebody. And my friend said, you mean he died? No, he didn't die. At least we don't think so. We lost him in time. And we didn't tell his wife. We just said he died in an industrial accident. But we don't believe he's dead. We believe he's lost in time. And we want you to go find him. And my friend said, well, I can't do that because it can't be controlled. But I can tell you what you did wrong. You tried to use it in air. You have to use it in water, or it can't be contained. And that was the end of that conversation. My friend never went to work for the utility and never helped them recover their lost man. These kinds of devices can be built, and they are being played with around the world. And you might, if you just stay aware enough, just well-read enough, you'll begin to see differences between what was and what is. What was won't be what was. It'll change. It'll alter. People that have been reported to have died in public life, you'll realize, didn't die. They're still around. What do you mean they're still around? I thought they died. No, they didn't die. What do you say? What do you mean? There's no record of them dying. Things are going to change. Everything around you is going to change. We just don't want you to lose your grip on it as the world begins to slip like mud beneath your feet or an undertow while you're surfing. Keep your eye on the wave. Because when that undertow gets very, very powerful, it means that a great wave is coming up behind you. And all you need to do is paddle, and you're going to catch it. And you're going to have the ride of your life. So when you go back in the past, in memory, in vision, in meditation, in your heart, and you make a change, the change comes forward with you. Ascension does not require death, you know. Ascension is a change that can come over you. In the scriptures, it's called a mighty change of heart. And it has little to do with belief. Belief is not the action word that we're talking about. We're talking about something more than that. We're talking about participating in it. We're talking about making it happen. Participating in it happening. And you can make it happen. You can make it work. To think that you are not in control of that is a misnomer. You are participating in time right now. You are having an effect on the present. And by the way, don't mistake the present with the now. You remember what I was talking about, the four-dimensional viewpoint, where the past, the present, the future are all one. It's all one spotlight. It's all one large viewpoint. And that's what we want you to stay aware of. We have another instrument that sort of came online and then it went offline. They spent a lot of money on it, and evidently somebody sized the wire wrong or wound it wrong. But the Large Hadron Collider melted down part of its detector wiring, and it will take a while because that particular portion of the collider has kept it very close to absolute zero, so it will take a while for it to warm up before they can get in there and actually fix it. Sorry, yawn. Somebody out there yawned, and it got to me. So it's probably going to come back online here in a couple of months. I think that we're probably going to be surprised at what we learn from that. It's probably going to open some small wormholes, some small black holes. But it's not going to be enough to suck the rest of the world down into it, so don't worry too much about that. the things that we learn about that are going to teach us about the beginning of the universe, and it will be quite interesting indeed, what we see there. And it's not going to be that difficult for you to understand what's going on, because you're going to be attached to it. I'm going to recommend a book to you. It's called A Dweller on Two Planets. I'll just set the book up for you. It was written by a 16-year-old who was the son of a doctor and did not come out of his room for some weeks, and much to the chagrin of his doctor father, who finally knocked on his door and said, "I want you to let me in." And the son said, I really don't want you to come in, because if you come in, you're gonna think I'm crazy." "No, I won't." So the son let him in. 16-year-old let his dad in, and all over the room were papers and papers and papers, stacks and stacks of papers. And the doctor father said, What is all this?" And then the son said, I don't know. All I can tell you is I'm being visited, and I'm being dictated a history. And this is the writing of it, and I don't know what it says." And the doctor, being intelligent and well-tooled, realized that all the writing was backwards, and it wasn't that difficult to translate. And so the book was published, A Dweller on Two Planets. The author, Frederick S. Oliver, but the actual writer, the 16-year-old boy. I'm going to read you an excerpt from this book, but you can pick up the book for less than $11. I want you to go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million and buy this book, A Dweller on Two Planets, The Dividing of the Way. It's also under ForgottenBooks.org. This particular page is called Atlantis, Queen of the Wave. When I finish reading this, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what showed up in this book and how fantastic a vision of the past from the future, which is our present, can be. "Why not?" I asked myself, pausing amidst the snow on the mountain, there so far above the sea that the storm king was ever supreme, ever while summer reigned below. "Am I not Atlan, a Poseidon, and is not that name synonymous with freedom, honor, power? Is not this my native land, the most glorious beneath the sun, beneath Incal?" Again, I queried, "Why not? Why not strive to become one amongst the foremost in my proud country? Poseidon is the queen of the sea, yea, and of the world also, since all nations pay tribute of praise and commerce to us, all emulate us. To rule in Poseidon, then, is not that virtually to rule over all the earth? Therefore, I will strive to grasp the prize, and I will do it too. And thou, O pale, cold moon, bear witness of my resolve," I cried aloud, raising my hands to heaven, "and ye also, ye glittering diamonds of the sky. If resolute effort could ensure success, I usually achieve whatever end I determined to attain. So there I made my vows at a great height above the ocean and above the plain which stretched away westward 2,000 miles to Kaifuul, the royal city. So high it was that all about and below me lay peaks and mountain ranges, vast in themselves, but dwarfed beside the apex whereupon I stood. All around me lay the eternal snows. But what cared I? So filled with new resolve was my mind, the resolve to become a power in the land of my nativity, that I heeded not the cold. Indeed, I scarce knew that the air about me was cold, was chill as that of the Arctic fields of the remote north. Many obstacles would have to be surmounted in the accomplishment of this design, for truly was what was I at that moment. Only a mountaineer's son, poor, fatherless, but, the fates be praised, not motherless. At thought of her, my mother, miles away, down where the perennial forests waved, where snow seldom fell, while I stood on the storm-kissed summit, alone with the night and my thoughts. One page out of A Dweller on Two Planets. Now, I'll tell you a little something about this book. This 16-year-old recorded an Atlantean's life, and the Atlantean could see somehow into our future. Now, mind you that this book was written, you know, way back in the 40s. And he was looking into our future. Our future. But it wasn't, you know, all past us. Things like computers, space flight, air flight, submarine flight, helicopters, all kinds of technologies that did come to pass. All recorded by a 16-year-old boy in backwards text and then converted into plain English and printed. That's this book, A Dweller on Two Planets. Just to give you the idea that time is the now, and our vision of it and what we can observe, and by observing, change. And by changing, altering the path of the future. Now, there would be some, many, in fact, neighbors of yours, teachers, preachers, parents, who have told you what is going to happen. That we are marching inexorably toward an event called Armageddon. That the world is going to be taken over by an Antichrist. That we are going to be plunged against our will into a tribulation from which, if we survive, we're not faithful enough. And if we're punished and suffer, we are not strong enough. Somehow there is no hope but to die. Don't believe it. You can change it. As easily as you change the molecular makeup of your body and thus the shape of your body and its capabilities, the genetics of your own system, the proteins that you make, the atoms that become the physical you and thus through which you interpret the universe, light and sound and touch and how you love, are all choosable by you. And remember, you control all of this. Maybe not what you have, but certainly what you are, and certainly what you do. First and foremost, you must have a dream. You must dream. I'm asking you to dream. Just the energy of dreaming will help you. Just the energy of dreaming will help you. And if you will dream hard enough and large enough and focus a fraction of your energy upon it, yea, even that of a mustard seed, it will come to pass. You will be and you will do what you dream of. If you don't dream of anything, in other words, you dream of nothing. That is what you will be. That is what you will do. And you will march beside those who march to Armageddon. And when you get there and look across the plains of Armageddon at the barrels of the other guns facing you, you will all of a sudden say, "How in the world did I end up here? How could prophets so long ago have predicted, in fact predestined us to march to this point of ultimate conflict and annihilation?" Indeed. manifested it yourself. I'm asking you, imploring you from a physics point of view, from a scientific point of view, from a paranormal point of view, choose another future for this world. Many are called, but few choose. I'm asking you to choose. New Year's is coming up in about a few days. I know, it's just October. But remember, we're talking about time here. So I want you to increase the scope of your time, increase the spotlight of your consciousness, and take in just a little more than what you are taking in right now. A little bit at first, maybe a week at a time. Look at the whole thing, past and future, and then affect it. And remember what one great teacher told me, and I still practice. Sometimes to my frustration, it does not matter who loves you. It only matters how you love others. That is what you have control over. That is something you can do. That is how you affect the universe. Oh, and by the way, remember another great teacher who also said, who laid down a set of very simple commandments for us. And actually, maybe they're not commandments. Maybe they're suggestions on a better life. He gave us three commandments in reverse order. One was, of course, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, might, mind, and strength. The second is like unto it, to love thy neighbor as thyself. Actually, three commandments all in one, in reverse order. Start it this way. Love yourself. When you do that, you will love your neighbor. And in doing those two things, you will love the Lord your God. It can do it. It can happen. It's not a large thing to do, and you can start on it today. Today is October 26th, and we're about out of this month, and I'm about out of my voice, but I appreciate you being here tonight with us, and we'll be back on the first Sunday of November, and we're going to have some authors with us, Charles Schwartz, Robert Balval. You're going to really enjoy the program in November. Thank you for being with us tonight, and we'll see you next time. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.